Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Today that he's feeling kind of excited, and he's going to feel liberated. The 11-term Republican power broker and former House Republican Majority Leader, who'd already stepped down from his leadership post amid allegations of wrongdoing, said this morning that he will drop out of his re-election race and retire in the next few weeks to ensure that a Republican will win his Texas seat in the November election. This morning on Fox Television, DeLay gave his first national television interview since news of his decision swept through Washington last night.
I think I could have won the seat, but it would have been nasty. It would have cost a fortune to do it. But
you've never backed away from a challenge before. That's how you got your nickname, the Hammer. Why not face up to this one?
The challenge has always been in the interest of the conservative cause and the Republican majority. And I'm more interested in growing the Republican majority than my own future.
So, what now for Tom DeLay and for the Republican agenda? We turn first to T.J. Olds, who writes for the Galveston County Daily News. He's one of two reporters who obtained an exclusive interview with Tom DeLay in his Sugarland home last night. And T.J., how did he seem to you?
Remarkably, Robin, at ease. I've been covering that race for 2.5 years now, and this was the first time that I can remember sitting down with Congressman DeLay and the jaws not being kicked out and the tension wasn't in the room. He was He was at ease playing with his dogs and chatting along. So that was it looked like a weight was lifted off his shoulders, actually.
As he has said, well, how about people in the area? It was sudden news, and I'm wondering if you have a sense yet of how people are responding to it.
Right now, it is still in early stages of shock, I think, really, as word came out last night here in the district. It was quite interesting, and it's kind of filtered down. Now folks have gone from that to what's next, because now a lot of things are up in the air. General reaction from folks, it's such a partisan issue when it comes to Tom DeLay. You either love him or you hate him, and you're finding that right now in folks as they react to this on the street as well.
He told you he was leaving because of polling numbers. He won the recent primary in this race to maintain his seat, but he said the polling numbers were bad going into the election. What did they show?
Well, they showed that a narrow victory, if the polls held out the way they were, too close to call, and as he said, too close for comfort and a little too risky for him to go forward, because he felt it was going to be a fight all the way to the end, something he's not used to, quite frankly, in running for office, and it would take up a lot of his resources, and figured that was the best route to go.
Well, let's take a look at the laundry list that his opponent could work with if he wanted to. Tom DeLay has been charged with improperly funneling corporate donations to Republican candidates in Texas. He's the unnamed representative number 2 in the corruption investigation of former Washington super lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Last week, a second former DeLay aide, Tony Rudy, pleaded guilty to conspiracy and corruption charges. And he told prosecutors about a criminal enterprise being run out of DeLay's leadership offices. I mean, did Tom DeLay mention this laundry list as another reason for his leaving?
He clearly points out that and anything that comes from that weighed into the decision big time. But he's also very quick to point out that he feels they're all either political attacks, or as he points out on the federal investigation, he says, hey, I'm not part of that directly. It's folks that I trusted who did this. But it is weighed in because, quite frankly, every single day he is seeing like the next shoe dropping in relation to particularly in the expanding lobbying scandal investigation. Every day something new to see to come out of that, and he says it was starting to become more and more of a distraction for him.
Right. Well, you write that Tom DeLay came to his decision to step down after a speech to the Christian group Vision America. What role might they play in his future?
It is interesting because I tried to pin him down of like when he talks about what he wants to do and it's after leaving office, and he talks about he still wants to push the conservative cause and issues, and these were all parts of a speech that he gave to that conference sponsored by Vision America, and he's got some friends in there, but he wouldn't commit to anything to specific, and it seems in just talking to him about that was kind of the epiphany speech for him. He'd been wrestling with this decision for a couple of weeks. And that was the speech that Steinman said, all right, this is what I'm going to do. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him, you know, go for an organization like that or a like organization.
And by the way, what was the epiphany? Did he say?
He said he'd been thinking about it. And when he was there, he just said, I let loose. That was the line he used in talking about the issues that he was passionate about. And he didn't have to worry about the political ramifications. He's never been one to hold back on what he believes in anyway when he says something. But in this case, he said he was really talking about those core issues of the cause that sometimes deal with politics and more deal with the moral fabric of the country, is what he said. And so he said that was the best term, straw that broke the camel's back that got him going.
And just core issues, what would they be?
The core issues for him is the conservative agenda, as he puts it. Everything from the abortion issue to tax cuts to homeland security to what is he called the war on Christianity. That's a very passionate topic for him, which was a lot of what his speech was. And he says those are the big issues that he ran on as a congressman that he still wants to push on now that he'll be out of office.
T.J. Olds, mainland editor of the Galveston County Daily News, one of just two reporters to have an interview with Tom DeLay last night on the eve of DeLay's announcement of his resignation from office. T.J., thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, DeLay's decision to leave Congress is sure to have an impact beyond Sugarland, Texas. Already this morning, Republicans and Democrats exchanging fire over DeLay's record. Republican National Committee Chair Ken Mellman issued a statement praising Tom DeLay for championing conservative legislation from welfare reform, to a ban on partial birth abortion. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee called DeLay's decision to resign further evidence that the Republican Party is a party in disarray. Well, we now turn to Mickey Edwards, former Republican member of Congress from Oklahoma, who teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Mickey, welcome to you.
Thanks.
We're also joined by good to talk to you. We're joined as well by Ron Elving, NPR's political editor. Welcome, Ron.
Hello, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. And Mickey, to you first, and your initial reaction to the announcement.
Well, I think that Tom saw that he had really a very, very tough race, and it may be that at this point it would be too close to call, but with all of the things that are piling up against him, most recently, another aide making a plea agreement, I think that he was probably not going to win that race, and I think he could see that, and, sort of hard to stay there and, raise the money and take the brickbats and then go down to defeat. I think this was for him just an easier way out.
Well, how do you think this will impact the Republican Party, given that he was at one time so good at raising money and he had been sort of hamstrung by these charges against him? How do you think it will affect the party that he's gone?
Well, I don't think it's going to affect it very much because, the fact is whatever issue the Democrats have about the kinds of corruption they think that Tom has represented, that's not going to go away. The issue is out there. It probably helps the Republicans in terms of being able to hold on to that seat because if he is dropped from the ballot and the party is able to put forth another candidate without that kind of baggage, it's a good seat for Republicans and good chance they can hold on to that particular seat. But I don't think it changes the political dynamic very much. Ethics problems the Democrats are going to exploit, and they're going to exploit it, just as much with him gone. They're not going to say, okay, now the issue is taken care of.
But Ron Elving, what about the leadership question? Again, his leadership had been somewhat hamstrung, but who rises up?
Well, John Boehner has already taken the job of House Majority Leader. He was elected to that job in January after Tom DeLay decided he couldn't come back and contest for it. That was after we saw Jack Abramoff, a disgraced lobbyist here in Washington with very close ties to Tom DeLay, plead guilty in a corruption case against him and some others. So that was the first shoe, if you will, that indicated that Tom DeLay saw he was going to have some problems with that particular investigation. Then, of course, we have Tony Rudy as has been mentioned. And there's another figure in all of this, Ed Buckham, who was chief of staff, not deputy chief of staff like Tony Rudy, and was an extraordinarily important person in Tom DeLay's operation in Washington. It's not clear exactly where he stands in all of this, but his name keeps coming up, and there are all kinds of allegations of what he might have been running, organizing and carrying out and executing for Tom DeLay. And if he's going to be involved in all this, then it's much closer to Tom than we had thought before, and he's in much more trouble.
Right, and when you mentioned that there are the shoes to fall, but you also mentioned that the leadership position was filled, and some would say, but, you know, DeLay was much more than just that title. He was the hammer. Is there someone, is Boehner showing himself to be a hammer as well, or is this leadership going to have to come from someone else?
With all respect to John Boehner, he's not Tom DeLay, and no one else probably will be able to. It's hard to overstate how much Tom DeLay has driven the train for this Republican majority since it became the majority in 1994, and taking nothing away from Newt Gingrich, who was, if you will, the Moses who led the Republicans out of 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, Tom DeLay has been more than just an enforcer. He's been a font of ideas, of fundraising, of energy, of drive. He was the man behind impeachment in 1998. He's had more to do with what the Republicans have accomplished, for good or for ill, in the Congress than anyone else.
And Mickey, does this resignation, does it reflect, as we heard just say, a party in disarray? Or is it, you know, a good jettisoning? Does it signal that the ship is being straightened?
Well, it turns out, I think, that it is a, to use your phrase, a good jettisoning. I think the difference was when Boehner beat and I agree that John Boehner's victory was significant here, had Blunt won and sort of continued the DeLay operation, even with DeLay not present, I think that would have been different. But John Boehner took the party in a different direction. Anyway, he's been standing up to Denny Hastert, the Speaker, on a number of different things. So I think in terms of the internal operation being, you know, pretty much intact, that's taken care of already. I would disagree a little bit in that the Republican leadership was not all Tom DeLay. Tom's personality got him a lot more credit than he might have deserved. The fundraising came from other people as well. The floor strategy came from other people as well. He was certainly a significant and powerful member, but I don't think it really changes a lot the dynamic inside the Republican Congress.
Well, in the minute or so we have left, Ron Elving, I'd like you to take a look at across the aisle. How does this affect the Democrats? Does it hurt them that, you know, this takes away their favorite whipping boy?
They do need a new poster child. We've lost Duke Cunningham, who's on his way to federal prison and was not a big name that people knew. So he can go down in a bribery scandal, and it doesn't really mean that much to the average voter outside his district. And Tom DeLay was someone who they were hoping they might be able to demonize and put in the role that they put Newt Gingrich in back in the 90s. Now they're going to have to look for somebody else, and that's a big challenge to them in terms of strategizing this year's election as a referendum on what they call the culture of corruption in Washington.
Right, and they continue to use that phrase as the scandals regarding lobbyist Jack Abramoff unfold, but this might have punctured it just a bit.
I think it makes it a little more difficult. They just need to come up with some new symbols.
Ron Elving, NPR's political editor. Something tells me they're hard at work as we speak. Mickey Edwards, former Republican congressman from Oklahoma, who now teaches at Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Always a pleasure to speak with you as well.
Yeah, thanks, Harlan.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Inflammation. It seems it's the most familiar and perhaps trivial of medical problems. You know, you get a little inflammation around a splinter. But doctors now think that inflammation may be at the heart of many serious illnesses. Joining us now is nationally syndicated health columnist and Here Now health contributor Judy Foreman. And Judy, first off, what exactly is inflammation?
Inflammation is an essential part of the immune response. The immune system is that part of your body that attacks germs, you know, viruses, bacteria, helps injuries heal. Without an immune response, we would literally all be dead. We need that to fight off the invaders.
So inflammation can be good.
inflammation is essential. Yeah. We really would not have evolved to our fine state today without inflammation. We really do need it. It's when there's too much of a good thing that we get in trouble.
Now, we think we know inflammation, for instance, when you get a cut and there's like a redness around the cut.
Right. It's red. It's hot. It looks bad. In fact, doctors call it a hot spot. That's the inflammation we can all recognize. What we don't recognize so much is the less visible stuff in our blood system. Our whole body is in a state of chronic inflammation if we're predestined to get some of these diseases of later life.
Well, let's talk about one of them. Let's say heart disease. As you write, the thinking has always been that heart disease was caused by, your veins and arteries got plugged up.
Right.
So how would inflammation play a role?
Okay, that's the best illustration of this whole thing. Yeah, we used to think it was just a plumbing problem. Now they know that LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, gets embedded in the walls of your arteries. And then your immune system, quote unquote, sees that and thinks it's a foreign invader and starts attacking. It sends white cells to the area, antibodies to the area, all these inflammatory chemicals. And it kind of keeps things in a revved up state, like chronic inflammation, all throughout these spots in your arteries where you've got LDL. And that chronic revved upness can cause plaques, these areas of deposits, to rupture. And that sends all kinds of, clots and debris and little fatty chunks around the rest of your system and can cause a heart attack.
Ew.
Is right.
So the inflammation causes, because it's aggravating the cells, it causes them to burst and
exactly
release this material.
Aggravating is a perfect word, yeah.
How would you apply the problem of inflammation to diabetes?
That's interesting because the first kind of diabetes, type 1, that's a direct immune problem. That's your own immune cells, by mistake, attacking the cells in the pancreas that make insulin. Doctors have known that for a long time. What's new-ish and interesting is that inflammation produces these chemicals that actually cause your body to be insulin resistant, which means you don't respond to the insulin you do make. And that's the problem in type 2 diabetes, which is now rampant in the country. So inflammation seems to directly make it harder for your body to use insulin, and that's just the first step in the pathway to diabetes.
We've known for a while that inflammation is a problem, let's say, with pain and arthritis.
Yeah, a lot of autoimmune diseases, which means autoimmune means your body is attacking itself. And like with arthritis, your immune system is attacking your joints, which causes a lot of pain and inflammation.
But the science doesn't seem as clear, at least according to the people you've spoken with, regarding cancer and inflammation.
That's right. I mean, that doesn't mean it isn't a big part of it, but it just hasn't been looked at as much. I mean, basically, cancer researchers have focused on the genes that get mutated and go bad in cancer. But they're starting to look at inflammation as a possible root cause of cancer as well. For one thing, when you're have a lot of inflammation, you're producing a lot of free radicals, which are these dangerous forms of oxygen that can attack DNA. And for another, some researchers have found that some of these inflammatory chemicals called chemokines, they're part of the inflammatory response and they're part of the chemical chain of events that happens when a localized tumor, a cancer tumor, spreads, metastasizes to the rest of the body. So some of the same chemicals seem to be involved in the inflammation response and in cancer spread. So again, that's another chemical link that suggests all this stuff is really intertwined.
Why would, you mentioned, for instance, in heart disease, that inflammation can be caused by bad cholesterol that gets embedded in the
right
walls of the veins and irritates
exactly
the system. Why else would you get inflammation? And I guess the second part would be, and what can you do to stop it?
Well, the interesting and kind of depressing part of all this is that a lot of the inflammation seems to come from fat cells, the kind of fat that's in your belly, called visceral fat that wraps around all your organs. And these little fat cells are actually, one doctor that I spoke to called them hotbeds of inflammation. They are pumping out these bad pro-inflammatory chemicals called cytokines. And that's sort of where a lot of this inflammation is coming from. It's coming from the fat. Fat is not a benign thing. They're active cells.
So we have to worry about fat as something that doesn't look good,
right,
doesn't feel good, but also is producing this negative inflammatory what do you call it?
Cytokines. Yeah. I mean, it's really fairly depressing when you think about it.
And by the way, you note that it's a particular kind of fat as well. It's the most dangerous, the kind that gets around your middle.
Right. I mean, they're sort of the apples and the pears, they call them. People who are pear-shaped have fat in their thighs, and they're not as much in danger. But the rest of us, the apples, have fat around our middles. And we're the ones in big trouble.
Okay. It's radio. We didn't have to point that out. But anyway.
I meant me.
But how do you stop it?
Well, you lose the weight, basically, which, as we all know, is not easy. But there are, you know, losing the fat around your middle is really key. And obviously, exercise is huge for that. And diet, too. There are various things you can eat that either make inflammation worse or make it better.
Including olive oil, you point out, instead of, let's say, butters.
Oh, yes, instead of butter. And anything with a lot of omega-3 fatty acids. That's fish like salmon and tuna, walnuts, flaxseed oil, all that stuff that people know is good for them, but they don't tend to eat as much as they should.
Are there prescribed medications?
Statins can work. Those pills that people take for lowering cholesterol, they also seem to lower this marker of inflation called CRP, C-reactive protein. Those are good. They do have side effects, and obviously no one's going to take them without talking to a doctor, but they are an answer as well.
And by the way, you mentioned there's a marker. Doctors are increasingly using this test to test to see if people have this inflammation.
Yeah, you can ask your doctor for this so-called CRP or C-reactive protein test, which is a marker for inflammation, which, because of that, is a marker for potential heart disease.
Judy Foreman, Here and Now health contributor and nationally syndicated health columnist. For more, you can go to our website to read her column. Judy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still to come, want a job for life? Many of those protesters in France do. Much more coming up here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR. Is closed, air and rail traffic are snarled, and demonstrators have once again taken to the streets across France to protest a new law that allows French companies to lay off workers under 26 years of age within their first 2 years of employment. After that, job protection laws kick in. This is the fifth nationwide protest French student groups and labor unions have staged to oppose the new labor law, and it marks 2 months of unrest. In a concession to protesters, President Jacques Chirac has proposed softening the law by reducing that probationary period to just 1 year. Supporters say the new law will make it easier for more young people to find work, but the protesters point out that the law will also make it easier for them to be fired. Sophie Fetter is Paris bureau chief for The Economist magazine. She joins us on the line. And Sophie, what are you seeing, first of all, on the streets of Paris?
Well, the turnout seems to be pretty good on the streets. We've got a real mix of people, a lot of students, a lot of union leaders, a lot of public sector workers, but also a few surprising members out there on the street, ordinary families, people who wouldn't necessarily join in these sort of protests, parents of the young people who feel that they are the victims of this new law.
Give us some context here, and we know that it has to do with jobs and employment, and that young people in Paris and France face unemployment rates of 23%, more than double the already high 9.6% overall unemployment rate. And then in some of the immigrant neighborhoods, it's up to 50% unemployment for the young people. Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin says that this new law, which he devised, would stem unemployment. How is that supposed to work?
Well, the real problem in France and the reason that there is so much unemployment among young people in particular is that there is so much rigid labor law on the statute books that a company that has the choice will always try not to create a new job if they can, if there's anything they can do by outsourcing, but to another country, by using computers, to put it crudely, in any way not employ people, they will do that. Now, this is a tragic situation for France to have got itself in because, of course, it created all these labor laws in order to protect the people who do have jobs. But it does mean that employers are really discouraged from creating jobs in the first place.
And we should add that many of the jobs that already exist are, in part because of those protective laws, fiercely held onto by people who don't, you know, who never leave them.
This is absolutely the case. Because of job protection, you've got, particularly in the public sector, jobs are almost jobs for life. It's very difficult to make anyone redundant, even if you're in some sort of facing difficulties yourself as an employer. So there is a real resistance among those who've got the jobs. But I think it's important to know why Dominique de Villepin, the Prime Minister, wanted to create this new contract in the first place. The idea was by making it more flexible, by giving employers some sort of scope within the first 2 years to lay someone off if things get difficult, He was hoping to encourage them to create jobs, but the trouble is he's ended up making the students feel that they're being victims while everyone else in the job market is left alone.
And it sounds as if it's part of an overall move on the part of some in the government to change the whole job structure in France.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's nonetheless a small step. I mean, no one was ever suggesting that this was a major overhaul of France's labor law. This was one small step in the right direction towards a more liberal labor market. It could, if it had gone anywhere, have led to something a little bit broader. But it was the right sort of thing, the sort of thing France needs. Unfortunately, we're now back to square one with this, and it has been, it has pretty much gone nowhere.
Sophie, there's a question that this has raised for us. It would seem as if students, young people in particular, would be out on the streets protesting the whole system, you know, protesting the people who hold on to jobs for life and protesting those protective laws which are sort of keeping them out of the job market. And instead, we read in The Economist that according to a survey, three-quarters of young people want a job for life. They want some sort of civic government job for life.
Well, I think that's what's so strange about the student movement. I mean, at the beginning, there were a lot of comparisons made with the May 68 student uprising, which was very much a sort of liberal movement to try and change the world, an idealistic sort of movement for a more progressive world. This group of students seems to be trying to cling on to a world, but what for me is the sort of central contradiction in all of this is that they're trying to cling on to a world that simply doesn't exist anymore for them. In other words, the world of jobs for life that their parents, some of their parents, did enjoy, but that for them doesn't exist because employers can't create those jobs anymore because they are too protected and too expensive for employers to set up.
Well, we should also point out that there were riots in the suburbs this past fall, but these were mainly young immigrants, and they were protesting against the system that provides jobs for life because they can't break into it.
In a way, there is. It does very much look as if you've got a sort of those who are excluded from the system and those who are protected by the system. But I think, in a sense, what unites them is that, you know, the people in the suburbs who, on the housing projects out there, who were rioting last November, they felt excluded from the job market at all. Students feel excluded from the decent job market, the protected job market. So there is sort of, you know, there is a sort of natural logic to this. It's those who feel that they are not getting the best out of the system, that the system is failing them, and they're not prepared to try a different sort of system, which might, in the end, create the kind of jobs that they're all in need of.
Mm. Here in the U.S., Sophie, I don't know if you've seen it, but one of the popular political cartoons of the last week was a frame that showed the largely white protesters that we're seeing again today, these college students, holding signs that said, "Let us eat cake." And I'm just wondering, you're saying, though, that there in France, they seem to be supported by the populace.
Well, I think what's so strange about France is that there are really sort of two halves to this country. There are those who are out there supporting them, including their parents and a lot of public sector workers. But there is also another France out there which is not demonstrating on the streets. It belongs mostly to the private sector, and it on the whole is part of a France which is incredibly capitalist, which takes part in globalization, if that's the way one can put it. There are a lot of incredibly successful French companies making a lot of profits, rewarding their chief executives just like they do in the United States. And this is the France that is actually not being heard at the moment. So although there are people out there in support of the students, there is also a silent France, which is, you know, quite appalled by what's going on. And I think that it's the gap between these two sides of France, which is so tragic at the moment.
Sophie, what do you think happens now? Where do you think this story goes?
Well, President Chirac has specifically asked for a new law to now be drafted, and various deputies are busy starting negotiations, which they hope unions will take part in order to draft this new law. And this is the new law that should or could end up replacing the job contract with something quite different. It all depends on whether the unions come to the negotiating table. I suspect that things will start to move, that the talks will begin, and you could end up with a new law that pretty much makes this whole contract absolutely redundant. And that would be, you know, it would be an end to the crisis, but it would be a setback for France, because it really does need to make changes to its labor law that will make it less difficult for workers to hang on to jobs forever. And that is what France hasn't come to terms with yet.
Sophie Petter speaking to us from Paris, where she's bureau chief for The Economist. Sophie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, still to come, remember Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction? She had nothing on the original Scorn Woman. We'll hear the story of the Portuguese nun from the 17th century and the French soldier who betrayed her. You're listening to Here and Now. March Madness, the April chapter, reaches its conclusion tonight when the Duke Blue Devils and the Maryland Terrapins decide the championship in women's college basketball. The sold-out game will be played at the Garden here in Boston. Meanwhile, kudos to Florida. The Gators captured their first men's college basketball title last night, beating the UCLA Bruins in the men's final in Indianapolis. Yannick Noah's son, Joakim Noah, played for Florida. He won the tournament's most valuable player honors with 16 points and a record 6 blocked shots. So what will happen tonight? Peter May is covering the women's Final Four for the Boston Globe. Peter, hello.
Hello, Robin.
How nice to be right here on your home turf with this game. And put it into context for us. Were these two teams, Duke and Maryland, expected to get to the Final Four?
Duke, yes. Maryland, no. I think most people who know women's basketball a lot more than I do have felt that they might be a year away. Duke was one of the top-ranked teams in the country all year long, so it's really no surprise that they're there.
Yeah, in fact, Duke is maybe making up for the Duke men's not making it to the finals as many expected
right.
They would. Well, Nancy Lieberman, you know, maybe the one female basketball player a lot of Americans feel they know, she says that Duke's going to take it all the way. But, I'm looking at Maryland, and they have one of their stars, if I got this right, is a youngster.
They start two freshmen. One of them is their point guard, whose father used to be an NBA referee. And taught her everything she knows. She's very good. The thing about Maryland is, as one coach told me, that they don't know how good they are because they're so young, and they're just kind of along this for the ride. And Duke is a very, very experienced team. They've got one of the best players in the tournament, Monique Curry, who's a fifth-year senior, and she came back to school for one reason, and that's to win a national championship. And I think a lot of people think it's their time that they're due.
And Curry's time in particular. Give us some names from the Maryland team.
The best player on Maryland is a sophomore by the name of Crystal Langhorne, who came out of New Jersey a couple years ago, was the player of the year. And then this girl in the backcourt, Christy Tolliver, whose father was the NBA referee. And then there's another woman in the backcourt by the name of Shay Doron, D-O-R-O-N, who was born in Israel. And came over to the United States and played in New York City area high school. Was a great high school basketball player there, and told us yesterday that she's not sure what's going to happen to her when she graduates because she might have to go into the Army.
How healthy are their basketball futures? You mentioned, for instance, Monique Curry. The WNBA is holding its player draft here in Boston tomorrow, sort of catching, you know, getting on the coattails of the game.
Right.
Are we going to see some of these girls headed for the NBA?
Yes, you will. The first pick is going to be Simone Augustus, who was with the LSU, who lost the other night to Duke. Curry will probably be one of the top four or five picks, depending on how it goes.
And how healthy is the WNBA?
Only as healthy as the NBA wants to make it. As a standalone business venture, it would not make it, but the NBA subsidizes it.
Well, hopefully with the increased interest in the women's March Madness, you know, maybe that'll transfer into more interest and more attendance at the WNBA games. And, you know, with that in mind, before we let you go, what's it been like at these games here in Boston, the Final Four, and, you know, what you anticipate tonight? What's it like?
I don't think Boston is a good town to host this thing in because it's not a college town in terms of sports.
What?
It isn't. It's a pro town. I think they should have it in a place that really appreciates college sports more than Boston does. And I'll probably get in trouble for saying that, but I do believe that. I don't think that there's a great interest locally in what's going on right now in the Final Four. I think people are much more interested in what's going on in Texas right now with the Red Sox.
What's the spirit like inside the game, those who want to be there?
It's fun. No, it's a good take. This is my third Final Four, women's Final Four, and I've enjoyed all of them. I particularly enjoy watching the way they play. From the NBA, it's a completely different type of game, and one that I tend to enjoy because it's more team-oriented, I think.
It's going to be high-scoring tonight, we understand.
It should be. Duke's a high-scoring team. Maryland's a high-scoring team, so it should be a high-scoring game, but that doesn't necessarily translate all the time because sometimes kids get tight in games like this, and shots don't go and passes end up going into the, you know, tuba section instead of to the center and things like that.
Peter May is covering the women's Final Four for the Boston Globe. Duke and Maryland play for the championship tonight here in Boston. Peter, thanks so much.
Okay, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
I was consumed by your assiduities. Your exuberance inflamed me. Your kindness fascinated me. You won me with your vows. I was seduced by my own violent inclination. And what follows such sweet and joyful beginnings are but tears and sighs. It is true. I found surprising pleasures in loving you. But they cost me strange sufferings, and all the stirrings that you cause me are extreme.
In 1669, five letters written by a high-born Portuguese nun named Mariana to the handsome French officer who loved and left her were intercepted and published, and the world of romance would never be the same. According to author Miriam Sear, until the letters, a tacit silence surrounded men's behavior in love. Mariana broke that code. For the first time, a female acknowledged betrayal and lust. Her passionate missives became instant bestsellers, inspiring literature by Browning and paintings by Braque and Modigliani, along with complete disbelief that a woman and a nun could have written those letters. Well, did she? Miriam Sear, a Canadian-American actress, spent 3 years tracking down the truth, and she's detailed it in her book Letters of a Portuguese Nun, Uncovering the Mystery Behind a 17th-Century Forbidden Love, and she joins us in the studio with what she's found. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what's your conclusion? Did she write those letters?
Absolutely. Because they're such an important stronghold of French literature and ultimately world literature, because they went on to spur a whole new kind of writing. The French believe that it was written by a French aristocrat. Their logic behind that is that a nun lost in the middle of nowhere in Portugal could never have loved in the way love is described in these letters. But of course, if you go back and you examine all of the historical context that surrounds how she was raised, what she did, the power she yielded as a person in her society, as a nun, it makes complete sense that she would have been more than capable of writing these letters.
Well, let's do that now, because you paint a picture of 17th century Europe. It's like a Terry Gilliam movie to read about, a Portugal led by an ugly drunkard king who wears five hats, and he, in Portugal, allies with France and England against Spain, and there's a war where people pull up their carriages to watch the bloodshed. And where does Mariana fit into this?
Mariana was born the year Portugal decided to rid itself of Spain. Spain had ruled Portugal for 60 years, and they would embark in a 28-year war. And by the age of 26, she had been a nun since the age, or in a convent since the age of 10, and had been raised to become a Western equivalent of a geisha, basically. And she was very learned in science, politics.
It's so odd. It runs against our expectations and our thinking about the convent that she was in was a paradise where these garrisoned French soldiers who'd come to fight the war, including her lover, took tea with the nuns and apparently a little more.
Well, yes, in this particular case, they fell in love. They were, in effect, these French soldiers were brought in the hope that they may become benefactors of the convent. And so they were, the nuns were asked to entertain them. And clearly this went a little beyond what was expected. So many men fell in love with nuns at that time because nuns were the ones that were the erudite women of the time, that there was a special name for nun lovers. They were called fretiricos, and that a law had been passed forbidding men from falling in love with nuns.
But it didn't work.
Clearly.
And so we have Mariana and Chamilly, who was the very famous and handsome and tall French soldier. who used to visit her in her little house. It really was quite a life for a woman in that she was, as you said, educated. She had her own room. She had a voice that many other women at that time didn't.
She had servants. She had the right to vote within her community. She had a job. She had a respect from male and female peers. So it was a very unique time in history when women within the confines of these convents were in fact ruled over their own lives.
Well, and yet what she couldn't control is that Chamilly,
yes,
Mariana's lover, he leaves the convent. He leaves her.
And we have these extraordinary letters that document, Rilke said that she deserves the diploma in the art of love.
Well, let's hear a little more. The letters take her through shock, disbelief, desperation, to rage. Tell us where you're going to pick up.
In the fifth letter, she has been forced to come to the conclusion that he will never return. Now, she's unaware, and that's interesting, that he, in fact, would always continue to love her, and it would take 10 years before he ever married. And when he did marry, he married the woman reputed to be the ugliest of France and would never have children. He never denied the affair, but he never confirmed it either out of respect for her. But she wasn't aware of the political machinations that pushed him away from her. And so in the midst of the fifth letter, she now understands that he will not be coming back and that he deserves her wrath. And she says, "Have you never reflected on how you treated me? Do you ever think that you owe me more than to anyone else on earth? I loved you like a mad woman. What contempt I had for all things. Your doings are not those of an honest man. You must have had for me some natural aversion not to love me madly, and I let myself be charmed by very mediocre qualities indeed."
Yeah, I mean,
it's just so great. I mean,
you can hear all of the world's women at that time sitting bolt upright, because had anyone ever really spoken this way?
No one. And so when these letters came out into the French salons of Paris, it suddenly created a forum for women in which to discuss their feelings of being abandoned and done over by men. And so it,
which was very acceptable at the time.
It was part and parcel of what you did if you were in a relationship. A man had every right to take on a new mistress, to abandon someone, and a woman just had to take it.
Tell us more about the impact of these letters. Dangerous Liaisons was taken directly from these letters?
Was inspired directly from these letters.
Well, I'm also thinking of Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction. It seems as if...
You know what? If you read these letters, you've been there before. I mean, everything that follows ultimately can all be found in there. And the letters went on to create a vital and very important turn in literature, because it suddenly brought out the psychological truth in writing and the birth, as it were, of the psychological novel was in these letters.
Not to mention, never a royalty. She never received a penny.
Oh, certainly not.
For what's been reprinted and reprinted and reprinted. Miriam Sear, her book is Letters of a Portuguese Nun, Uncovering the Mystery Behind a 17th Century Forbidden Love, a Historical Mystery. Thanks so much.
Thank you. But I want nothing from you. I am mad always to speak of the same things. I must leave you and no longer think of you. I even think I will write to you no more.
Duas lágrimas de orvalho caíram nas minhas mãos quando te afaguei o rosto.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, and Virginia Prescott. Matt Odette is our engineer today. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Daniel Estrin and Molly Hamill. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Porque choras, não me dizes. Não é preciso dizê-lo, não dizes, eu adivinho. Os amantes infelizes deveriam ter coragem.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com. Deberiam ter coragem para mudar de caminho.
Pelo amor da musa. PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and the